Our program continues with tape three.
Octopi can change color. Well, most people, I think, assume that they do this for camouflage. That would be a reasonable assumption. They don't do it for camouflage. Let's talk about octopi for just a moment. First of all, they're mollusks. They divided from our evolutionary line 700 million years ago. They're related to escargot. They have no backbone, for crying out loud. They're not even vertebrates. But what is always said in biology classes about octopi is that they're a wonderful example of parallel evolution because their optical system is very much like a mammalian optical system. Well, why is this? Well, it's because they evolved in an environment, the reef environment, that is an environment all as dense with signals as a rainforest is. And an octopus is soft-bodied. It can not only change color, but it can also change its surface from smooth and rubbery to bumpy, pimply, rugose, ribbed, so forth and so on. And also, because it is soft-bodied and in an aqueous environment, it can fold and unfold and reveal and conceal parts of its body very, very quickly. Well, all of these behaviors and physiological characteristics go together to make the octopus an excellent visual communicator. And the color changes, the blushes, traveling dots and bars that these creatures manifest, and the squids do it too, are language. And if you're interested in this, there's a wonderful book by a guy named Monahan called Communication and Non-Communication Among the Cephalopoidea. And he goes as far as creating a grammar for this stuff. Well, so then, in a way, you know, if you pull back from the mundane assumptions about this, what's happening is the octopus wears its mind on its skin. It is dressed in its mental state. One octopus encountering another can tell its mood, how recently it's eaten, how recently it's had sex, whether it's ovulating, all by looking. And so the only way an octopus can have a private thought is by squirting ink into the water and then hiding inside it. This is essentially... it's correction fluid for misspoken octopi, you see. So, in a sense, this is what I think we are being beckoned toward, that we want to clothe ourselves in language. We do it to a degree in a funny way. I mean, if you want to think about virtual reality, this is a virtual reality. All this stuff, these fixtures, the architecture, the infrastructure, the road, these are ideas. It was an idea, and it has then been summoned into matter by the allotment of funds, the spending of money, the hiring of craftsmen, so forth and so on. Our whole civilization is an excreted set of interlocking ideas, agreements. We're like coral animals. And we, somewhere, you know, there's this naked, pulpy creature, but, you know, clothed in denim, clothed in a harder shell produced by Mercedes or Chevrolet, moving around inside a larger environment produced by the state of Colorado, and so forth and so on. So I think octopi offer an excellent metaphoric example of what naked-mindedness would be. And some of these octopi, as I said, they evolved in the coastal reef domain. But that's a very competitive domain. Everybody in the ocean wants to be there because that's where the sunlight and the food is. So if you're smart, you'll try and evolve into a more hostile niche. And some of these octopi have become what are called benthic or abyssal. It means they exist in the parts of the ocean where light never reaches. Yes. And they have retained this communication ability by switching over to interiorly generated phosphorescence. So there are species of octopi which actually are studded with organs that have the equivalent of eyelids over them, but they're flasher lights. So when you descend into the benthic depths of the ocean, you enter a domain where all one octopus ever sees of another octopus is its linguistic productivity, because that's interior generated light that can be seen. And I think, you know, if you want to set the compass of virtual reality towards something worth writing home about, then producing an octopus environment so that we could experience this kind of thing would be a kind of proto-telepathic playpen of some sort. Yeah.
I guess it's skeptical enough to occupy other words whose colors that aren't really indicative of what you're thinking of, where still words align as we do.
So you think that subterfuge enters here too?
Yeah, that was my real question. My real question is, last night when you were discussing the role of psychedelics in human evolution, and you were going by a strictly Darwinian theory.
Right.
I assume since you're associated with Rupert Sheldrake in various endeavors that you entertain other theories. And if so, have you considered the possibility that psychedelics may influence evolution, the evolution of humankind in a very direct way. In other words, have a direct effect upon DNA, so that, you know, this selection.
Well,
you
want me to?
It's a central dogma of biology that information can get out of DNA, but can't get back in directly. In other words, it can only be selected for over a
few
generations. Have you played around with that?
Yeah, well, you raise a lot of issues. First of all, since the discovery of retroviruses, of which the HIV virus is one, we now know that it is not always information transcripted from DNA to RNA to protein. The retroviruses transcript from RNA to DNA. So the central dogma, which is that the genome is not being altered by the environment, is sort of shaky at this point. You bring up a very interesting point, which has never, to my mind, been really thrashed out in orthodox science, which is, if you had a bunch of these psychedelic molecules and we could raise them up to the size of loaves of bread or something like that, what you would notice about them is they're all what are called by chemists planar, meaning they tend to be flat. They're not lumpy. They're flat. Well, if you look at DMT or harmine, harmine is built off a pentexyl group and with two benzene rings off of it. It is the perfect size to slip in between two nucleotides in DNA. It can actually bond into the DNA there. Now, many drugs do this. These drugs are called dimers. The usual problem with a dimer that will intercalate, this is the other term, intercalate means slide between the rungs of the DNA, is it usually deforms the DNA. It like passes a bulge along it, and then transcription is difficult. But these indole hallucinogens can dimer with DNA without disrupting its structural integrity. This is why I believe that this is the source of the visions, that, and, you know, orthodox biologists just roll their eyes at this idea and say, well, now you've made a very common error here. You've confused genetic information with information. Don't you understand that genetic information is just a sequence of codons coding for protein? And, you know, that has no relationship to your memory of Aunt Minnie's face. However, by being so yielding on that point, they create a huge problem for their brothers and sisters across the hall who are trying to understand memory. Because the molecular theory of memory is a nightmare. Here's the problem. Every molecule in your body is changed every 5 to 7 years, depending on who you talk to, except neurons. The nerves are generally the nerves you're born with or the nerves you die with. But it's an absolute no-no to suggest that memory is lodged in the neurons. Well, but if Aunt Minnie died 45 years ago, and you can still remember the dear woman's face when she used to walk you in the park, then every molecule of your body has been swapped out 5 times since she quit the plane. How can you have this memory of Aunt Minnie? They don't say, actually. They just throw up their hands. Now, to the people who say DNA can't store any kind of information other than codon sequences for proteins, they have to explain why then 90% of the genome seems devoted to junk sequencing that does not produce protein, that does in fact not do anything that anybody knows about. It seems to me that we might as well just take the path of least resistance and say, if the neurons are the only part of the body that persists throughout life, if the memories persist throughout life, then you've got two choices. Either the memories are in the neurons or the memories were never stored in the body in the first place. And if you'd believe that, well, then the obligation to explain just where they were stored is hard upon you and the mechanism for retrieving them. So I think molecular biology, by being so reductionist, has made certain problems in neurophysiology and higher cortical functioning almost insoluble. For years and years it was held that this was another one of these central dogmas of biology. It was held that information could move from the nucleus of the neuron to the synapse, but that there was no transport mechanism for moving any molecular species from the synapse back to the nucleus. So consequently, they said learning cannot take place in the nucleus of the neuron because the materials for learning, which would be present in the synapse, modifications through experience, there's no transport system. And this was dogma until 10 years ago. Well, then they discovered what's called axioplasmic transport, and they, by putting labeled compounds in the synapse, they were able to locate these labeled compounds later, complexed with nuclear material in the neuron, proving to the most diehard materialist that synaptic material was in fact moving backward to the neuron. So I think that there's much that isn't understood about how all this works. Something worth pointing out, science seeks closure and explanation, explanatory closure. My brother one time made a little aphorism, which I think says it all on this subject. He said to me once, actually on a mushroom trip, he said, "Have you ever noticed how as the sphere of understanding grows ever larger, necessarily the surface area of ignorance gets ever bigger?" Seems perfectly clear. A simple-minded way of saying that is, the bigger you build the bonfire, the more darkness you will reveal. Yeah.
And also, any progress really comes from outside the context of the paradigm that's having the experience. I mean, it really, to my knowledge, almost everything that's really been advanced in any science or philosophy is really something that's come from outside the context of the paradigm.
Yes, well, some of you have probably read Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he shows, that it's never the way they tell it afterwards. the after telling is always about the primary insight, the careful experiment, the gathering of data, the correlation. Actually, it doesn't work like that at all. It's entirely psychic, piecemeal, ruled by synchronicity. One of the most interesting things, I'll tell this story and then we can go to lunch, because I think, you know, science has great pretensions about itself. I mean, it basically regards itself as a meta-theory. It regards itself as capable of passing judgment on all other theories. They are supposed to submit themselves to science to be told whether they're real or not. Yeah, like a religion. Well, how many people know modern science was founded by René Descartes in the early 17th century. What were the circumstances under which Descartes founded modern science? René Descartes was a 19-year-old, basically ne'er-do-well, and he decided that he would go wenching and soldiering across Europe, which was a thing that young men of certain class did at that time. And so he joined a Habsburg army that was laying siege to Prague in the summer of 1619, and after they had taken care of the problem there in Prague, this Habsburg army began to retreat across southern Germany. And on the evening of, now there's a lot of arm wrestling about this, but let's just say the 17th of August, 1619, this army made camp near the little town of Ulm in southern Germany, which, synchronicity freaks, pay attention. Ulm will later be the birthplace of Albert Einstein. Worth noting. But that night, Descartes, in the barracks, had a dream. And an angel appeared to him. And the angel said, the conquest of nature is to be achieved through number and measurement. And he was thunderstruck. He took that angelic revelation and turned it into modern science. Modern science was founded by an angel. You know, they don't tell you this at MIT. It's astonishing how things which claim roots in rationalism are actually among some of the most irrational productions in the historical continuum. It appears that our development, our history, our histories have always been created at the promptings of invisible voices. I mean, Socrates, who is at the very center of what's called thinking by Western civilization, Socrates had a demon, D-E-A-M-O-N. It was a little voice. It was his crap detector. It told him the difference between profound philosophical thinking and bullpucky. And so, the edifice of Western thinking built on Platonism owes its debt to an invisible agency speaking from hyperspace. So does modern science a la Descartes. How much more of this? I mean, we don't care if artists talk to angels, because our definition of them is that they're screwballs. but to believe that an enterprise like modern science has to trace its way back to the same ecstatic roots is, I think, very suggestive that the world is stranger than we can suppose, and that we need to open these channels of communication to these invisible worlds. Probably the next great paradigm shift will be enunciated by a mushroom, an angel, an elf, an alien, what have you. Yeah.
So the EMT trip, what was your technique to bring that and hold on to it?
Repetition. Yeah. The first few times I did it, I couldn't get any grip at all on it. And by talking a lot and trying to describe it, you slowly, slowly build up a map. So, about the Logos. The Logos is this phenomenon that was sort of the centerpiece of Greco Hellenic spirituality. And what it is it's a voice in the head that people strove to attain for 1,000 years. This was the sine qua non of intellectual accomplishment in the Greco-Roman world. And the Logos told you the right way to live. And this is sort of what you get with psilocybin. You get a voice that can confound you with the depth and brilliance of its answers. And one of the great, you know, one of the puzzles of trying to understand Greco-Hellenic spirituality is, what were they talking about? And if this ever was a general phenomenon, then what happened to it? Why do we not experience this? This is not well understood. I mean, the rational scholars who have created our vision of Greece basically just don't even want to talk about this. They would rather gloss over it. You know, one of the things that sort of relates to all this is, I think human beings are a lot more malleable than we tend to imagine. In other words, we imagine that people in the distant past or in Greece or somewhere were just like us, except they were living in a different time and place. There's no way to find out, of course, because they're all dead. But there are certain episodes in the evolution of Western culture that suggest that people may be much more plastic than we ordinarily suppose. First example would be, how can it be that in the middle 1500s, perspective was discovered? I mean, how do you discover perspective? This is very hard, I think, for modern people to understand, because it's a given for us. I mean, we see in perspective. We accept it as a quality of the world rather than a cultural artifact put in place at a certain moment. But in fact, during the Renaissance, only the most inspired people could paint in perspective on the natch. Most people, they had complex devices called perspectigraphs that would project over the scene a receding grid, and then people would essentially fill in the lines. Now, another example of this kind of thing that's not so well known, but that is an example that Marshall McLuhan makes a lot of, is St. Augustine, the great father of the Christian Church. He had a reputation for being a very holy man, and the accounts of his contemporaries say that the way people would satisfy themselves that St. Augustine had a pipeline to God is they would bring him scripture, the Bible essentially, and open it in front of him and let him look at it, and then they would close the book and question him about what was there. And he could always tell them. And they were amazed. As far as we can tell, St. Augustine was the only man in Europe who could read silently. Nobody else could do it. It was regarded as a miracle. Now, we all read silently. And there may be a few unfortunate individuals among us who move their lips while they read. But that's the only vestigial trace we have of this previous cultural mode where everyone... to read meant to read aloud. No one could conceive of any other way of doing it. The Logos seems to me a kind of similar thing. It was a mental behavior function which, for reasons which are probably complex and unknowable, slipped out of reach. That's why it seems to me these psychedelics are very close to being able to modify our behaviors along these kinds of lines, because there are a number of behavioral and experiential possibilities that we suppress. I mean, I think it's just as an example of how little we know about what's going on. Look at the Gaffenberg, don't look at it, but conceive of the Gaffenberg spot the G-spot. Now, we all know what this is. Clearly, people were looking for it for a long, long time. How come they only discovered it 12 years ago? I mean, if something that major can be overlooked, then it's hard to imagine what might have been overlooked. I mean, that's pretty central into the project of being a human being. And apparently it was unknown until very, very recently. So, yes, the Logos was probably what I call the Gaian mind. And that at a certain point in cultural development, people just became so chuckle-headed that the Gaian mind just said, "What the hell with this?" And then the voice fell silent. It fell silent right at the around the time of the birth of Christ, right at the time of the shift of the zodiacal aeon, you know.
Would you consider maybe giving us a phenomenological answer like you did with the ayahuasca or the DMT vision, relative to how this, from your experience, other people that you've talked to, just how this...
how it works with psilocybin?
Yeah, what you have experienced and you've been talking to.
Well, I mean, when I take psilocybin, I take it on an empty stomach. I don't fast or anything like that. I just don't eat for 6 hours. I don't call that fasting. And then I take it in silent darkness. That's number one, very important. The next thing is weigh the dose. You must weigh the dose because 5 grams is what you want. And I've had over and over the experience of showing somebody what 5 grams is, and they're appalled. They say, "My God, you can't be serious. I mean, I take a fifth that much, a fourth that much." Yeah, well, that's the problem. That's why you don't have elves in the attic and bats in the belfry like I do, you know. And so then you take it, and I take it on an empty stomach, and a lot of people don't like the taste. I don't really understand that. I just chew them up. I sit with them, and I chew them up. And then, huh?
Dried.
None of this mixing in applesauce or any of that malarkey. I mean, what's that about? Oh, well, fresh, 60 grams. 60 grams. Because there's more than a, you know, there's a huge water loss there. And then it takes, people sometimes say it came on within 5 minutes or it came on within 10 minutes. I don't know what that could possibly be about. First of all, it defies pharmacodynamics to imagine that it could come on that fast. For me, it comes on almost always at the 1 hour and 20 minute mark. I think it can come on sooner than that. I think I'm fairly resistant to these things. In the hour, after I take it, I sit, I roll bombers, and I carry out what all good Catholics know as an examination of conscience. This means you think about all the bummers that you're afraid are going to jump out at you as soon as you get loaded. If you will carry out the examination of conscience, you'll be so bored with that by the time the compound actually hits that you usually don't have to pay any dues because you've, you know, faced the fact that you're a jerk 50 times in the preceding hour. So, and then the way I do it is at about the hour and 20 minute mark, and I should say in the time preceding that, you may have to go to the bathroom once. You may, it makes your nose run, which is a funny thing. It also makes you yawn. These are definitely qualities of psilocybin, not related to its psychoactivity. And I think that it's very good to decide before it hits that once it begins, you will not alter the plan. In other words, you decide ahead of time, I'm going to sit here and do this, because at about the hour and 15 minute mark, it will begin hitting you with stuff like, you'd really be more comfortable downstairs, or, you know, it's awfully hot in here, why don't you get up and adjust the thermostat, all this stuff. You say, no, we're holding the space, and sit there. And then it begins to come on. and it comes, the image I have is like a jellyfish or a silk scarf or something like that. It just kind of drifts down and surrounds you. And at that point, I guess I pray. I say to it, you know, I'm completely in your hands. Please don't hurt me. You know, I'm yours. I'm completely committed. I've held nothing back. So don't burn me, please. And then there is a kind of, it's hard to describe, a kind of potential begins to build up. And you say, the rush hasn't begun, but it's, you can almost close your eyes and see millions of little psilocybin molecules elbowing serotonin molecules out of the way and fitting themselves into the receptor site, and the electron spin resonance dynamics is beginning to shift, and the whole thing is about to take off. At that point, I smoke furiously, and that usually is all it takes. And it comes on, and the first rush is really astonishing. I mean, sometimes it's more mind-boggling than others, but I can remember situations where I would just see it coming and say, oh my God, you know, it's 100 miles wide and 10 miles high. Where are you going to run to? You know, it's just, you say, good grief. You know, I guess I'm not going to meet this one sitting up. I think I better lay down. And in about the time it takes to make and execute that decision, then it just hits. And it's like a tidal wave. I mean, I have the feeling when I'm doing it in California that everybody from Vancouver to Tijuana has just crawled under their desk, because you can't imagine this is happening between my ears. You know, it's more like an asteroid must have fallen in the Pacific Ocean and raised some enormous incoming wave. It's what it's sort of like. It's like watching a thermonuclear explosion through 50 feet of crystal clear glass. So, you know, you're perfectly calm. It's not getting at you. But the energy that is being released in your presence is awesome. And then it... And sometimes in that first pass, you actually, the linguistic machinery is burned out. You've probably seen these scenes where they will test a hydrogen bomb and they set up cameras a quarter mile from ground zero, a half mile, a mile, 2 miles. And then when they actually detonate the bomb, they get the view from the first camera. And then they switch to the second camera as the first camera is blown to bits and vaporized, and they keep pulling back as each successive instrument is destroyed. Well, this is sort of the feeling you have as this thing spreads out toward you. And then it does what it wants to do. It tells you what it wants to tell you, and it's highly unpredictable. I mean, people always say you should ask it a question. This seems absurd to me. I mean, I don't know. Once when my life was in turmoil, I did ask a question. I said, I wrote it down ahead of time, and the question was, am I doing the right thing with my life? And then when I got in there and I posed the question, and the answer came back instantly. It was a ripoff from Lyndon Johnson. It said, what kind of a chicken shit question is that to ask me? I said, oh, sorry, didn't mean to presume, you know. I said, get your act together and then we'll have a conversation, but if that's what you want to talk about, you should have taken MDMA. And it... And then, you know, paralleling what we talked about this morning, and again, I'm just giving you my subjective take on it, it's like I come into a place. It's hard to describe. It's a feeling. And the content of the feeling is, now the elves are near. but they won't appear unless I invoke them. And, you know, I wish I could tell you that I chant in Mandayan or something like that, but I don't. I stole a line from an old I Love Lucy program where Ethel is talking to Lucy about UFOs. And Lucy says she talks to the UFOs. And Ethel says, well, how can you talk to UFOs? And Lucy said, well, it's simple. I just say, come in, little green men, come in, little green men. And that's what I do. I say, come in, little green men. And then there is, and women, if there are any out there. And then there is a, it's like a marching band. It's like a Nepalese marching band is what it's like. And it comes from a distance. Like there's a place in my vision that's small, a little dancing light and a little faint sound. And the light comes closer and the sound gets louder until finally, you know, they pick me up on their shoulders and with tubas blaring and sackbut and rebeck and all of this stuff. And then they carry me around and talk to me. And the whole thing is shot through with such a weird sense of zaniness, Irishness, Joyce-ishness. I mean, it's almost unbearable. It's so, I don't know, not exactly Disney-esque, because their humor tends to be a little more savage than that. And then that is part of the first wave. And then the rest of the trip unfolds pretty much as you, there's a kind of a pushing and pulling that goes on. You can direct it. Each one of these plants does have a character of its own. Sure. One of the most puzzling things about these plants is that they have characters that seem irreducible. For instance, psilocybin, it is the science fiction drug. In other words, it says, you know, we have been denizens of this planet for 400 million years. Our original home planet is in the M5-83C system. We are connected via hyperspace to all intelligent life forms in the galaxy. It shows you enormous machines in orbit around alien planets. It talks about the end of history and the collectivizing of humanity, and it's this enormous, hortatory, salvational, dramatic, science fiction type scenario. Well, then you take ayahuasca, which in molecular terms is just a few nitrogens are moved around. I mean, it's basically the same thing. And you get a completely different message. You feel the energy of the rainforest and the rivers, and it's very feminine. You think about childbirth. You think about the continuity of generations. You think about the mystery of the meat. You think about tantric sexuality. It's all redirected back into the human and natural world in some way. And then, of course, DMT, which I described this morning, which the DMT elves are not from outer space, or they don't present themselves that way. In fact, one of the odd things about the DMT thing is that you have the feeling that this space that you break into, even though it's large, some people even refer to the dome of DMT. That tells you they really were there. But wherever this huge vaulted space is, you have the feeling, although it's hard to explain how you know this, but you have the feeling that you're way, way, way underground, which fits with the elf motif. You're in the hall of the Mountain King. You're under the hills with the, you know, the little people who retreated under the hills. The character of these things is one of the most puzzling things about them.
And how do you relate all these different species of gremlins to the logos that chose the part?
Well, that's a real question. The logos seems more it first of all, it doesn't crack jokes and do quadruple entendre puns and stuff like that. It's more like a wise and loving teacher. These DMT things are, you know, it's a troop of maddened elves, and they are just doing their own thing. And then with ayahuasca, though some people claim they contact an entity, it hasn't been like that for me. It seems to me that on ayahuasca, you become like a camera. You just fly through a visual world. I mean, after a good ayahuasca trip, you just feel like your eyes are bugging out of your head. I mean, it's like buying prints on Madison Avenue, you know, and you've just been looking and looking and looking, and you literally have to give your eyes a rest after an ayahuasca trip. And the ayahuasca visions are more, they seem to cover a broader spectrum. The psilocybin hallucinations tend toward this highly polished, machine-like, insect-like, outer space bit. And the ayahuasca hallucinations are wonderful pastels, laces, layering of colors. And then one of the most interesting things to me about ayahuasca, and I just cannot understand how this works. If I could, I'd be Erte or somebody. And that is that you, in the middle of the ayahuasca trip, you can suggest motifs. You can lead it so that, for instance, you can say to it, Art Deco. And suddenly there will be thousands of candy dishes, cigarette lighters, champagne buckets, automobiles, stained glass windows, doorknobs, silverware, all rolling in black space in front of you, all the perfect exemplification of this aesthetic, the Art Deco aesthetic. And then you can say to it, okay, Italian Baroque. And it just, like that, suddenly altarpieces, Madonnas, martyred saints, and fantastic scroll work and fleur-de-lis. And you can say, well, surprise me. And then you will get a coherent style, like Art Deco, like Italian Baroque, except that it's nobody's ever bothered to realize it on this planet. But it's as coherent. It's like, you know, 20 years ago there was no such thing as Southwest as a style. You know, this weird thing coming out of Santa Fe that I notice has planted its roots deep here as well. The turquoise and beige endlessness of feathers and hammered titanium and all that. Well, that's an aesthetic that has cohered in the last 20 years and come into being. There seem to be an infinite number of these things, as different as the bronzes of the Han Dynasty are to a Dali or a Pollock or a Bosch. And then you can say to it, going beyond the surprise me challenge, is what I always say to it is, I want to see more of what you are for yourself. And then it's like there's this low organ tone, and it begins to lift the veils, and the temperature in the room drops about 20 degrees. And after about 20 seconds of that, you just say, enough of how you are for yourself. Because you can tell what's happening is it's starting to reveal something so peculiar and so untailored for the human mind or eye that you become afraid. You say, you know, can we go back to dancing mice, Art Deco cigarette lighters and Baroque altarpieces, please? This is turning into deep water as far as I'm concerned. So, yes.
What happens on higher than, if anything, higher than 5 grams?
Oh, that's a good question. Good question. It requires a small detour into pharmacology. the concept, which all pharmacologists are familiar with and which you should be too if you're going to deal in this realm, called LD50. This is not a pretty notion, but a necessary one. It stands for lethal dose 50. What does this mean? It means if we have 100 mice, how much psilocybin do we have to give each mouse to kill half of them? Do you see? LD50. Half the sample dies at the LD50 dose level, whether it's graduate students or rats. Now, when you're designing a drug or when you're thinking about a drug, what you want is a drug with an extremely high LD50 opposed to its effective dose. So say the effective dose of psilocybin is probably about 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. And the LD50 is probably 200 milligrams per kilogram. The LD50 of psilocybin is 400 times the effective dose. This is a pharmacologist's way of saying this is very, very safe. A pound wouldn't kill you. I don't think. It might be getting close, but you'd have to eat in that range to die. Now, some drugs have horrendous LD50 to effective dose profiles. Unfortunately, and I hope I don't rain on anybody's parade here, MDMA has a terrible LD50 profile. The effective dose is 125 milligrams. You can kill yourself with 1,000 milligrams. So that's not good at all. Because sure as hell, some street person or some depressed person or some maniac is going to take 1,000 milligrams. And then you've got a stiff on your hands. So, yeah.
I recently read some info on MDMA indicating that serotonin, depressed serotonin levels on MDMA the serotonin stays low in your body for about a week after taking it, whereas like a related substance called E, the serotonin levels are depressed for only 2 hours, and the researcher indicated that his conclusion was that MDMA had some physiological toxicity that E did not have, and therefore it might be wise to avoid it for that reason.
Well, in fact, I've read an article that is destroying the serotonin receptor sites.
I thought about liver tests before and after about 300 milligrams. There was a difference.
There was a difference. Well, I think MDMA is, I don't want to trash MDMA. It's changed a lot of people's lives and saved relationships and so forth and so on. But to me, it's a perfect example of why you're better off taking plants. Because here was this drug, somebody invented it. They gave it to a few friends. It seemed to be wonderful for solving personal problems. So without any collection of human data, this thing becomes an item in the underground. Well, and so then thousands of people take it. The psychological effects seem completely benign. It's a wonderful thing. The physiological effects, it's a very disturbing profile. It isn't exactly as you said. It's not that it destroys the serotonin receptor site. It's that nerves, neurons, are covered by these very delicate structures called dendritic spines. Now, nobody knows what dendritic spines do, but every neuron in your body has them. And when you take MDMA, it mows them down. They go away. Now, so then you get two schools of thought. One says, well, my God, anything impacting the physical brain that dramatically should be stayed away from. And the other camp says, well, do you see any behavioral changes in people who take MDMA a lot? Do you see any physical destruction, seizures, blindness, anything? And the answer is no. So they say, well, here we have histological evidence that this thing is making major physiological changes in the dendrites and no behavioral sequela to back up that this is of any consequence. Well, my position, being basically a very conservative person, is in that case, wait. You know, they're doing work on this in a dozen labs around the country. They'll figure it out. In the meantime, take psilocybin or mescaline or something else that has been sanctioned because you just do not want to insult the physical brain. You know, that's the whole name of the game. You have to keep the brain in good shape. Yeah.
Could we drift back to his question? Once you're past the trigger dose, is it worthwhile to start to step up?
Oh, yeah. That's where we were talking. That's why we started talking about LD50, because I wanted to explain to you that taking a drug like a compound like psilocybin, if the effective dose is 20 milligrams for somebody who weighs 135 pounds. Well, then looking at the pharmacological data, they should be able to take 2,000 milligrams without any trouble at all. That's 100 times more. But in fact, what happens is as you raise the dose is that the psychological presentation becomes unbearable. It becomes so strange that you fear for your sanity, in a good old Edgar Allan Poe-ish phrase, you know. It gets stranger and stranger. And, you know, I've talked to pretty naive people who have overdosed. Usually the way these overdose situations occur is people are gathering mushrooms in the wild and they start eating them, and then they just keep eating them. And then they realize they've eaten four times more than the effective dose. And this is where you get into places where you don't know what to say. Because if you tell people, they'll throw a net over you. But you want to say, because you're so personally disturbed. This is where the flying saucers land and the rectal examinations begin and you're told that you're the Messiah, and they, you know, it becomes quirkier and quirkier. So I think you have to, you know, I'm very admiring of people who can take very high doses, but I find it quite challenging enough in the 5 to 7 gram range. A friend of mine says of psilocybin that every time he takes it, he tries to stand more, meaning more of the vision, because it is filtering itself. It's definitely filtering itself. This is why beginners almost never have bad trips, because somebody in there looks at your clipboard and says, oh, this guy has never done this before, so lay off the rough stuff. Just, you know, bring him through the standard number. It's the people who consider themselves experienced, you know, who've done it 20, 30, 40 times, says, you know, we can take the gloves off with this guy. And in, you know, it always amazes me. I sometimes meet people who say, you know, I've taken mushrooms 50 times and I've never had a bad trip. And I think, you know, lucky soul. Because when it goes left, it's hard. You know, it's hard. You have to really then, you know, do not your mantras bungle is the best advice I can give you, because you need to steer back toward the mainstream. Now, maybe at this point, this is a good point at which to talk about what do you do when the going gets rough. There are two things, at least, that you can do that are very effective. The first is, and it's a very simple thing, but people in our culture seem to be resistant to this, is you sing. You force air into your lungs and body and you chant. You sing anything you want and it will radically alter the parameters. There's a certain place in psilocybin that is my bête noire, which I call the meat locker. And I don't like this place, you know, and meat locker is a mild term for it. It's more like, the morgue for the homicide unit or something. Whenever I start drifting that way, I sing, and then you can navigate through it. The other thing you can do, although this is sometimes trickier, is smoke cannabis. This is what those bombers are for that you rolled in the first hour while you were waiting for it to come on. Is as soon as it begins to press in some really invasive or alarming way, just take a couple of hits of the good and chant, and then you can bring it back on track. And also talk to it. Don't be afraid to say, I don't like this. Take it off me. It's too peculiar. I'm not ready for this. It says, oh, sorry, back to dancing mice.
Different batches of mushrooms have wildly varying concentrations of psilocybin?
Well, there hasn't been a lot of work on this. Michael Buckley at Evergreen College years ago grew Stropharia cubensis by the method that's described in my book, the book I wrote with my brother. And what they discovered, see, psilocybin is 4-phosphoryloxy(N,N)-dimethyltryptamine. That phosphorus group is removed as soon as it crosses the blood-brain barrier. So really, what's active is a simpler compound called psilocin. And psilocin lacks the phosphorus attachment. And what they discovered was that in the early flushes, the psilocybin ratio is high and the psilocin ratio is low. And in the, you all know what a flush is, right? And in the later flushes, the psilocin level rises and the psilocybin level drops. So really, the two together stay remarkably stable throughout the life of the organism. Something worth mentioning, I suppose it's worth mentioning, is when I was into my extraterrestrial phase, when I was assuming that the mushroom was an extraterrestrial, either the extraterrestrial itself or something designed by some kind of an extraterrestrial, it was very interesting to me that psilocybin is, as I said, 4-phosphoryloxy(N,N)-dimethyltryptamine. It is the only 4-substituted indole in nature. The only one. Well, if you were to search for evidence of extraterrestrial tampering with the biome of this planet, what you would look for is a unique compound occurring in one life form and no other. Here it is, folks. This phosphorus group is unique, and I've never read any description or discussion of what the evolutionary history of that, why it would appear in an organism like that and not in any other. That's just an aside, because I'm always searching for the thumbprint of the alien. There may not be an alien thumbprint, but the phosphorus group attached to psilocybin is a good candidate for it. Yeah.
Switching the subject only slightly, the descriptions that you've given of all of these experiences, although you have said that it varies widely, there is a remarkable internal consistency of your description, that you're entering a world that seems to have boundaries and entities that you consistently encounter again and again. I've spoken to many people over the years, some of whom have known you a long time. And nobody I've ever spoken to, people who've taken high doses or low doses, have ever had similar experiences. Now, clearly you've talked to people who have. So I'm wondering,
maybe they were just being polite.
I'm wondering if you've ever experimented with your own experiences, like what Lily describes in programming and metaprogramming. And to see, you describe ways of evoking the entity, which certainly could be put into a context of introducing programs into your experience.
True.
Have you worked with different presuppositions going into this to see what the limits are?
Well, my original presupposition was to try to have no presupposition at all. And then out of that came all of these assumptions. You're right that nobody has trips exactly like mine. Although, if you question people carefully, you can begin to see what how it works. For example, you know, I described this thing this morning, the elves, the presentational thing, the high-speed motion, the gifts, all that. Well, sometimes people will take DMT and they will come back and you'll realize that it's as though there is an archetype there which has different levels in it. And if I had to say what the archetype of DMT is, it's the archetype of the circus. And one time I saw a woman come out of DMT. She was an anthropologist. She had fairly high body weight. And I could tell that she had not gotten a complete hit. Came down. We said, okay, what was it? She said, it was the saddest carnival in the world. She said the carnival was closed. All the tents had their flaps rolled down, and there were just paper cups and candy wrappers blowing in the aisles in between them, and the Ferris wheel was stopped. Well, she was just at the edge of this thing. And if you think about the archetype of the circus, it is an interesting one. First of all, you have the three center rings, where wild and zany activity is continuously being presented. Tiny cars keep arriving with 14 clowns in each one, and they keep climbing out, falling all over each other. But it isn't all fun and games. It has a strange erotic content. And as a child, I think my first awareness of what I would really call eros was watching this beautiful long-haired woman in a tiny spangled costume hang by her teeth 120 feet above the center ring doing acrobatics. So you've got... So you've got the clown and you've got the lady in the tiny spangled costume, and then off from the center ring you have these dark alleyways where the sideshows are, the Siamese twins and the goat boy and all the rest of it, you know. And it has a very weird vibe about it. So it can land you in any of these places. But if you try and correlate people's experiences, it seems to me that it's pretty clear that through their own life history and their own programming, nevertheless, something is trying to poke through. Now, my DMT experience seems pretty radically different from other people's, although other people don't give any account at all. I mean, it's amazing how inarticulate people are. They come down, you say, how was it? And they say, it was far out. You say, you know, you don't get out of here with that rap. You know, how was it? And you say, well, they can't give a good account. On psilocybin, I think most people experience something very much like what I describe. Huge machines, a sense of danger to the earth, apocalyptic visions, the idea that someone will come and help. And I'm pretty resistant to all the flotsam and jetsam of the New Age. I mean, I don't spend a moment worrying about the exact physical location of Atlantis or stuff like that. And I think people, it inflates their personal mythologies and intellectual misconceptions. But there is something trying to get through. That's why this exercise, show me what you are for yourself, is really a good one. And maybe my trips are so weird because I have always worshipped weirdness. So I can go further down that road without being alarmed while somebody else, you know, would pull back. One of the problems is that we don't have complete maps of these places. At this stage in exploring that new world, what we have essentially are the scribbled diaries of frightened explorers. And we don't know if Explorer A is talking about the same river system as Explorer B, or whether they were on opposite sides of the planet or the universe. Building a coherent picture of the psychedelic dimension would be the first challenge to a rational approach to understanding it.
Have you ever read Five Journeys by Robert Monroe?
Is that the first book?
No.
No, I read the first book.
Well, it actually is a map. Talk about weird, which is one of the weirdest things you would ever read. But it has an amazing ring of truth in it. And in it, he presents a map of all of the realms of beings that exist, that he's visited just normal consciousness. It's almost an anti-psychedelic description, but it's pretty consistent with some of the things you were discussing this morning, because this is where you go when you die, and it's also where you go when you sleep. In fact, he talks about classes you attend in your sleep. And he describes these levels upon levels of entities coexistence. And he describes it like a canvas that happens to be dropping in at this point.
Well, I read the first book, and I was puzzled by how much of it didn't seem familiar to me. Like, I remember in the first book he talks about a world that's just like this world, except the cars are 9 feet wide. That would be a very puzzling psychedelic experience, to go to that world. I knew someone who was very close to him, and I don't want to set off any lawsuits here, but I once cornered this person and said, "So what about it?" And he said, "Don't worry, you don't have to worry. This is not getting close to your bailiwick at all. Buddhism of the Mahayanas has, a tremendously complex system of levels and entities. Wrathful Buddhas and Dharmapalas and peaceful entities. And I think that that's pretty interesting as a phenomenological description of mind. I reject the philosophical premise of Buddhism because I think it's, an unbelievably uncompromising kind of nihilism. But Buddhism, as it's pitched in America, soft pedals that a lot. You know, they don't present it as a form of nihilism, but I think ultimately it is, in the most positive sense. But still, I'm of the school that follows Alfred North Whitehead, who said, "Say what you may, there are certain stubborn facts." And, you know, that's not a very Buddhist point of view. Yeah.
Do you have visions on cannabis too?
If I can control myself and not do it too often. The problem is cannabis does so many other wonderful things, and I tend to use it for those other wonderful things. But if I were totally dedicated to vision, then I would only smoke once a week, because then you completely come to equilibrium. And then, I think people do it not wrong, but not the way you should do it if you want visions. You should do it the way you do all these other things, alone in silent darkness and at high doses. Bursts of hallucination on cannabis are hard to control and predict, but sometimes they're as intense as anything can be. If you read 19th century descriptions of cannabis use by people like Fitzhugh Ludlow and the Club du Hashashin and that crowd, where they were eating the hashish, it's very clear that it was the LSD of the 19th century. I mean, nobody can read those descriptions without realizing these people were loaded for sure. They were thoroughly and completely smashed to be able to write those kinds of accounts. Yeah, go ahead.
So it's interesting, you said you smoke a lot at the start of the mushroom trip. And when I smoke a lot at the start of the trip, it's tend to really confuse entry, and then eventually I kind of realize, it has an effect which, and I'm not sure that's a good effect in terms of getting the learning, shall we say, from the more powerful chemicals.
Well, you didn't exactly make clear to me what the effect was. It fuzzes you out going into...
It depends on the smoke, I suppose. If you have very top-grade sense of me, it will do one thing. If you smoke Colombian, it will do something totally different.
What it does to me is it just slightly cuts my anxiety. You know, I'm able to let the thing unfold of its own. I don't know. I mean, I have a lifelong, intense relationship to cannabis, and I basically make my living out of being able to do feats of memory. And, you know, cannabis is supposed to trash your memory. So I don't, you know, maybe I'm different, but I resist any maybe I'm different argument because it's malarkey. Nobody's different enough that they can, you know.
In terms of your articulateness and memory recall, when you're at the peak of the kind of experience, is it still, you know, speak as clearly then? I mean, I get really tongue-tied.
No, more so. My great dream is that as my powers of locution fade with old age, that cannabis will be legalized. Then I can sit in front of you and smoke, and my career can be pushed 20 years further into the future. The way I use cannabis is to think. And I do a lot of thinking. I do a lot. And at night, before I go to bed, I smoke. And then I play the tapes of the day, and then I understand what happened. If I didn't have cannabis, I don't think I would be sort of at sea or a kind of a space case, because I never get what somebody really meant, really intended, really had in mind, till I play the tapes stoned, and then I see, aha, that's what the agenda was, or that's what was going on.
You can go to sleep
afterwards? Oh, yeah. Yeah, and if I don't smoke, then I'm insomniac. Yeah.
I don't know how far you want to go with all this, but I'm really interested in how you compare methadone and all the experiences together that you talked about. How do you think
about it? Okay, well, LSD, again, you remember, I'm only speaking for myself because there is no other way to approach it. I found LSD very interesting, but ultimately kind of frustrating, because I wanted visions. And to me, what LSD by itself does is it does a lot of slippery and hard to name stuff. It accelerates and changes the quality of thought. Well, basically, that's it. It does something to the quality of thought. But I had been reading Aldous Huxley and Havelock Ellis and those people, and I kept saying, you know, where are the ruins of alien civilizations? Where are the jeweled tapestries? And then, fiddling around with LSD, I discovered that if I would take it with mescaline, then it became the psychedelic experience that I was seeking. But in and of itself, it's kind of psychoanalytic. It's sort of like cleaning up your act. It often focuses you on your own personal stuff. And, you know, I have to confess to you, I'm not that interested in my own personal stuff, probably because it's so horrendous. But I don't like personalized trips. I like cosmic vision information trips. And then mescaline is, you have to take a lot to get it to really do what you want it to do. And it being an amphetamine has not a very good LD50 profile. It's not like MDMA, where 10 times the effective dose and you're in real trouble, but probably 40 times the effective dose and you'd be sweating bullets. So, and then just the nature of my life, I've not had as much to do with mescaline as these other things. I'm really a vision freak. And people say, you know, well, there's feeling and there's insight and there's this and that. But the reason I'm so fixated on vision, or the excuse I give, somebody said it's because you're a double Scorpio. But to me, it's the proof that it's not coming from me. I can come up with insights. I can come up with funny ideas. But I can't come up with objects never before seen by the human eye or mind. And so when the visions start, then I feel this is the transpersonal part of the trip. This isn't my unconscious, my memories, my fears, my hopes. This is something else. Yeah.
Last night you were talking about boundary dissolution and ego reduction. And what you described this morning, I mean, how do they relate?
How do boundary dissolution and...
How do your descriptions of the trip this morning relate particularly to ego?
Well, I think in very practical terms, they show you that everything you know is wrong. You know? I mean, how can the ego survive that piece of information? It just puts in your lap incontrovertible evidence that everything you ever thought or believed is hokum. And that's extraordinarily humbling. And that word, humbling, means the feeling you have when your ego is reduced, you know? Humble yourself enough and you'll begin to feel humiliated. And, you know, that's a deeper ego reduction. I think they, aside from any magical chemical effect they might have on ego, they're just simply showing you the true size of the universe and your place in it. And, you know, in our down personal lives, every man, every woman, a king or a queen. I mean, we build castles in the air. Our career, our children, our whatever. Well, then you get into those places. You just say, you know, what? How preposterous.
This is a dangerous kind of question. I think maybe is there any gender difference in these things?
For men and women? Well, that's an interesting question.
I'm interested in that also in terms of history.
Yeah. You mean what we talked about last night? Well, I think women, by virtue of the fact that they menstruate and give birth, are just inherently more chemically driven creatures than men. Men are Apollonian in intent. The idea is always some kind of abstract purity, clarity kind of thing. And women know from the get-go that that's an illusion, that the reality is the floor of the rainforest, the interconnected tissue, the levels, the trade-offs, and so forth and so on. This is why I think generally men tend to be more interested in these things than women, and to also be more impacted by them. For women, it seems to sort of fit in and affirm what they knew. For men, it seems to come as a tremendous surprise that this is the way things are put together. I think that if everybody gave birth and experienced menstruation, probably we never would have launched ourselves into history. In a way, you know, without going too far with it, men are the ancillary sex. I mean, the original blastula in the embryonic development is female. And I was listening to somebody the other night talk about this, saying no wonder men have the problems they have. What a man is a woman who has been under incredible chemical assault for 9 months in the womb. And you just have been hammered, sculpted, shaped, and recast again and again. And then you're born male. A female fetus doesn't experience anything like that. It starts out with a smooth shot at its end phylogenetic expression and then achieves it. I don't think of the ego as particularly male because I think we all have it to excessive degrees. But men are able to express it. A woman with an ego is frustrated. A man with an ego is a menace to all concerned, you know. So, yeah.
How do you feel about taking a trip with another or other people? Do you think the question of energy and personalities changes your trip?
I think it's a very major decision to do that, that if you're going to take a high dose of psychedelics with somebody else, then you better be prepared to get all entangled with them. which can be great. It can also be fairly confusing. I don't like taking psychedelics. This is not an issue of entanglement. That's sort of what goes on between lovers or close friends. But I get a lot of requests to sit for people, and I don't do it because I don't know whether it's my personality or what it is, but I am unable to contain my anxiety in the presence of another stoned person, especially if I'm stoned. If I'm stoned and they're stoned and we're in a dark room, I cannot get off. I listen to them breathe. I worry. I wonder if I should ask them if they're all right. Then I go off on long trips about not interrupting them. And then that loops back into, but I haven't heard them breathe for 20 minutes. And I'm always afraid. I don't know. So really, people say, doesn't it take courage to do it alone? For me, it takes more courage to do it with people, because inevitably then you get tangled up into some kind of craziness. And, you know, you can think you're having a telepathic experience, and they've decided that they want to have sex or something. And meanwhile, I've just had a revelation about that entry Molière made in his diary when he was talking to his niece Agnes about the nature of the French comic theater. And so you say, boy, you know, we've got too much on the menu here. But I'm weird. Remember that. Yeah.
Okay. Now, and we have heard about the common vision shared by people in ayahuasca. So can you comment on this kind of thing and contrast it to what you're talking about, which is extremely high doses with the one half?
You mean the group mind on ayahuasca?
Yes. And is that possible?
Oh, yeah. No, it's very possible. It's very possible. I mean, you can sit with someone and play a little game where you will describe the hallucinations for 30 seconds. Then they get to describe the hallucinations for 30 seconds. And you can absolutely convince yourself that people are seeing the same, you know, that you're seeing the same thing. And, you know, when you toss sex into the mix, it just goes over the top. I mean, I've had the impression, I don't want to trot it out as a position of mine or something that I assert as true, but I have had the impression, stoned on mushrooms, making love, that it's like perspiration forms on the surface of the skin, and there's some kind of electrolytic thing that goes on, and the boundaries dissolve between the people. I don't mean metaphorically. I mean that you become one organism, and that's pretty amazing.
That's fair to your partner feels
it. Yeah. Now, after I just said I don't like taking psychedelics with people, I guess what I should have said is I hate being responsible, because I don't mind taking ayahuasca with 30 people, none of whom speak English, in a hut up some river. But that's because I know that the old shamans are in charge, that I'm just a face in the crowd. Nobody's going to turn to me for explanation or help. I'll tell you an ayahuasca story just to give you an idea of the kind of stuff that goes on in these sessions. Years ago, in 76, Kat and I, it was before we were married, were in Peru, and we had found this shaman who was very good, and he had a following. And we were, you know, apprenticing ourselves to him. And he, the style of these Peruvian mestizo people is that, I mean, cultures handle this differently, but they are never straight with each other. It's an incredibly masked culture, almost like the Japanese, but without the formality. In other words, if you think somebody's a jerk, you would never say that. That's the last thing you would say, because that's your true opinion. So we got into a situation with these people where this elder shaman, who was very respected, beloved even by these people, he had a nephew, a sobrino, who was an absolute jerk. I mean, this guy was into pimping a little on the side, and he was very ambitious to perfect his ayahuasca so he could go to Lima and charge yuppies a bunch of money for taking it and so forth. And he had this really awful habit, and I don't know what was really had gone on before we got there, but they would all get together to take ayahuasca. And these old guys, you know, 80, 85 years old, the totally authentic dudes, would sing these beautiful ayahuasca songs. And he would sing against them. I mean, can you imagine a scene like this where everybody's singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat, except one guy wants to sing 5'2", Eyes of Blue, and does. And the level of social tension in these meetings would just rise and rise, but nobody would ever say anything to this guy and tell him to bug out and can that crap. So one night, this had happened two meetings in a row. It was the third meeting like this. Everybody hoped this guy wouldn't come. So then he showed up. So then we all dose. Then we get loaded. And the singing begins. And he begins his singing. And in the wave of hallucinations, and Kat was sitting next to me, he was sitting up on his haunches, kind of rocking back and forth on his heels. And I would look at him, and I could see he was going through these weird animal transformations. First he would become like a jackal, then he would become like a monkey, and it was really intense. And I mentioned it to Kat, and she could see it too. Well, so then he kept, and we were also trying to tape these ayahuasca songs, so it was a double irritation to us that this guy was so out of control. So after a particularly long song by the old guys with him just hammering against them, I could feel Kat, who has a real Irish temper, getting more and more pissed off at this guy. And finally, at the end of this song, when the silence fell, she had been just staring at the floor, and she looked across the room at Don Jose and gave him a look of pure loathing. And I saw these red things, these red triangular shaped things come out of her eyes and go across the room like and when it got to him, it knocked him off his feet. He was thrown backwards from the impact of these things, literally, and everything going on in the room stopped dead. And the elder shaman said to the guy sitting next to him, he said, "Oh, the gringa sends the ba-da-da-da-da." And, you know, then you realize, wow, we're in over our heads here. You can't tell shit from Shinola in this scene.
This concludes tape 3. Our program continues with tape 4.